Welcome, everyone. Good afternoon. This is Sundays with the Modern. To those of you who are not familiar with the program, each Sunday, with some exceptions for holidays, though not obviously for the stock show, we invite prominent local artists, art historians, architects, and others to have a conversation with us about works on view, their choice. Next week, we welcome artist Francis Bagley, and more details about that and other programs are available at themodern.org. Today, we host art historian Benjamin Lima. Dr. Lima holds a PhD from Yale University and joined the faculty of UTA in 2009, so a recent addition. His field is modern and contemporary art with a focus on post-World War II art from Europe and Germany in particular. And given the Modern's collection, we're very, very happy to have him in the area. He's published widely in the field, including contributions to Art Journal and Art in America, and is currently at work on a book examining experimental and event-based work in the 60s. You have an additional opportunity to hear Ben speak on the photography of Berndt and Hilla Becker at TCU on Thursday, February the 1st. Benjamin Lehman. I'm sorry?
That's the third.
Oh, the third, sorry. Benjamin Lehman. And by the way, he will be taking questions if you have any.
Is this, did I turn it on all right? It's working? Okay. Well, thank you all very much for coming. I'm very happy to see you all here. And as Michael said, I'm eagerly anticipating challenging and provocative questions as well. Since I normally do research and writing on German material from the 1950s and 60s, I actually, for today, wanted to not talk about that and do something different, because I think many of you have probably had this experience that it can be very rewarding to come to something with fresh eyes, to challenge yourself by trying to think about something that you're not familiar with. So what I want to discuss in the event today is basically abstract work, abstract painting, and a few works that are not painting. And what I want to do is make three stops, more or less chronological, and at each of these three stops, talk about a group of work that's hanging together in the galleries. And we can think a little bit about why it might be hung this way and what the works have to say to each other. And at each stop, before we move on to the next one, I would invite you to make questions or comments after we take a look at each of these works, so we can tie it together that way. These three groupings that I want to look at can be thought of more or less chronologically, in the sense that we'll be moving kind of from earlier to later, but not completely, in that there's some overlap, and there are certain artists of different generations whose works are hung together. And that in itself, I think, is also interesting. You can see how a younger artist must have been aware of and responding to the work of an older artist, and the kind of challenge that takes place when such a work is hung together. So as I said, I want to focus on abstract work. And if we're talking about abstract work, you know, one of the things that we could say in general about a lot of this work is that the artist wanted to take some kind of phenomenon, some complex aspect of the experience that we all have in day-to-day life, and reduce it in some way, reduce it to some element that allows you to focus in on that one element or a one set of elements, to kind of cut away and pare away extraneous or accidental or extra kinds of material, and just look into something very, very intently. So I think that certainly ties it all together. On the other hand, by narrowing our own focus this way, I hope we'll be able to also think about the very different and diverse kinds of choices that each of these artists makes. In other words, how a work by Ellsworth Kelly versus a work by Callum Innes versus Adolf Gottlieb, once you are in the mentality to be examining it, can seem to be totally, totally different in spite of these certain things that they share, their commitment to abstraction. So why don't we go ahead and make the first stop, and we'll look at some works that generally belong to abstract expressionism. I think it's very dramatic the way the collection begins with these works by Kiefer, but I'm just going to skip over that today. So I'd like to look at least a little bit at each of the works that hangs in this gallery, and we can kind of rotate around and take them one by one. Now, the works in here all belong more or less to the group that's known as abstract expressionism. And there are multiple generations within this group and different kinds of backgrounds of the artists. But I think from the perspective of art history, a couple of points are important. Number one, this movement took shape in New York in the years after World War II. And what this means is all of the artists involved, as was the entire cultural artistic scene at the time, were very much shaped by responding to the experience of the war. And secondly, the fact that a lot of elements combined to bring together an unusually talented and committed group of artists in New York at this time meant that many people thought that New York was able to challenge Paris as being the so-called capital of innovation, of novelty, of ambition, and it seemed at this time that the complex that American artists had for a long time about kind of catching up to Paris or following Europe or being kind of a little bit behind seemed to be disappearing. And so I think if you take a look at some of these works, you can maybe get a little bit of a sense of that sense of self-confidence and ambition that was so apparent in New York at that time. As far as the kind of ideas or attitude that were common to many of the abstract expressionists, if we take for granted that they're working in terms of abstraction, this term that I mentioned at the beginning, which is to say the idea of reducing complex experience to a simpler, a more focused set of elements. These artists were certainly abstracting, as are the other artists that we're going to look at. But what's distinctive about the abstract expressionists, and this is implied by the second word of their title, the expressionists, is their interest in an emotional, personal, committed, passionate kind of experience. And they had a sense of what you could call the kind of human drama, or the sense in which people's experience and the kind of existential challenges accentuated by the horrors of World War II were capable of creating these intense emotional experiences, which their response to which was to say, instead of making a representational painting, instead of drawing figures and a background, we're going to translate that intensity of experience right into the fundamentals of the brush and the canvas itself. So since it's kind of central to this gallery, I want to focus on this work by Clifford Still to kind of stand for some of that idea. Clifford Still, by background, and if you can, you might want to take a few steps closer so that it kind of, I think a good place to be is where it kind of fills your vision. So if you feel up to it, to come to the point where you're almost within arm's reach of it, but not quite, where it's kind of taking up your field of view. Clifford Still, by background, was from the Great Plains, a family background in Alberta, Canada, in Washington State, in North Dakota. He eventually moved to the East Coast and settled partly in Maryland, spent time in New York. But I think you can see the kind of grandeur, the kind of great scale that that you could suggest comes from that broad open sky of the Great Plains. One of the things that Still is doing here that's common to a number of the other works around here involves a very careful deployment of the areas of color and areas of white, and even some areas of unpainted canvas, which you can see the kind of at the margins of the painting, such that the figure and ground, the sense of figure and ground, which is common to virtually every textbook academic composition, is foiled or mixed up. So there's the kind of center of attention of the composition is over here, at the right hand half of the painting and the kind of lower two thirds of the painting, but that's counterbalanced out by making this immense area that seems like the background actually this very bright yellow. So the yellow kind of comes forward too. So if you're imagining a kind of textbook realistic composition, if you placed a figure or a group of figures where this kind of complex is, and then had the rest of the upper and left area be kind of open sky or background or something like that, you'd think of it as a kind of unbalanced composition because the figures would be all over on one side and the ground would be left open. But I think that the way he's kind of balanced out the different tones and hues and levels of color actually sets you up so that the whole of the canvas is energized. This is something that many of the abstract expressionists appreciated about Mondrian. Piet Mondrian, you can see a couple of Mondrians over at the Dallas Museum, many of you, I'm sure, have seen Mondrians elsewhere. But Mondrian's interest in creating a composition that would be dynamically active all over the field of the picture, as opposed to having a center and margins, was something that was really important for a lot of the abstract expressionists. So Mondrian is a key factor. Another one, actually, that we can see as we walk around and see some others too, is the sort of New York intellectuals and New York artists' version of or understanding of Eastern Asian, specifically Zen Buddhist philosophy. And what that boils down to in their writings and their talks and so forth is a fascination with how a sense of nothingness can be something. And I'm not an expert on Zen, and you know they weren't either, most of them. And so I'm, you know, if any of you are experts in Eastern religion, you can correct me. But their basic sense of how taking something away can actually add to something and leave you with a sense, a sort of purified sense, a sort of heightened attention to what's left over, to the void or to the space. You know, if you just imagine walking into a completely white room with nothing else there, all of a sudden you're aware of the shadows, you're aware of the gradations in light from one side of the wall to the other. That sort of purified, simplified experience is something that that made a lot of had a lot of meaning for them that time. So there's these certain themes that I'm mentioning as we go that connect together a lot of these works, the impact of Mondrian, and then Mondrian being an artist who came to maturity in the 1910s, 20s, 30s, and painted his last big works in New York in the 1940s, of the following generation, of this generation of work, another artist whom we're not looking at right now, but who is a similarly central figure is Barnett Newman. And as we come to these next stops along the way, many of the artists that we'll look at were similarly fascinated by the way that Newman would have these single huge canvases bisected by what he called a zip down the center, a single little line. And the way that, that one narrow little line, often a bright red or orange, would kind of focus you and like center you in the middle of this field so that the rest of the canvas then kind of surrounded you and just it kind of placed you in the center of this space. Mondrian and Newman were some of the people that these artists were thinking about. So instead of giving long spiels about these other works for reasons of time, I thought maybe I could just pause for a second and see if someone wanted to make a question or comment, and then we can go along to our second stop. Yes. Yes. By sorry.
My height.
No. I don't think so. Well, I think in each of these cases, I think the artists were certainly very aware of human scale, and I always think that trying to define the scale of the work and think about how the artist wanted to scale the painting is always a very important thing that you have to do in kind of sizing up or measuring up a picture. Still was known for his extremely dense, heavy pigments. So that's, I think that's a very accurate thing to say that he was even actually criticized at one point or another for having it be maybe a little bit excessive. Like it's not here so much, but in other works it threatens to kind of just become a pile of, the impasto becomes, I don't know what the word for it, but, too much. So the other thing I would say is that such a bright color, so densely packed, could be, it could become the focal point of the painting. But again, I think, as I was saying, he's kind of worked hard to, he's made it actually fairly small, right? It's small compared to the black and the orange. And so he's tried to balance it so it's not the single focal point of the painting. A fulcrum, great word, yeah. Yes, I would.
Compared to the heavier pigments and the use of palette knife, and is there something in his background that
in Motherwell's
to or educational background that puts him more in alignment with the European?
Oh, interesting.
In terms of the surface, the refinement.
That's a good question. If anyone didn't hear, the comment was about how Motherwell, if we look over in that corner, I'll just start walking here because after this we'll move on. Motherwell's hand is quite a bit more elegant than Still's, and the sort of the significance of that. Motherwell was certainly known for being the most writerly. Motherwell, among all the abstract expressionists, was a prolific writer and curator. He published an anthology, The Dada Painters and Poets. He was very well educated. He'd studied at Stanford University, Harvard University, Columbia University, undergraduate and graduate school. He studied philosophy and art history. So he was steeped in the sort of high cultural tradition in a way that the others weren't. So as to the question of whether that may be a little bit to the side of the question of his manner, but much of Motherwell's work, including this work, included conscious references to European art and European history and so forth. The last thing I want to say before we move to the next room is that since we brought it up, if we look at the Motherwell here and the Gottlieb over there, one of the points that's often brought up, I'll stand in here so you can kind of look at them both. We already mentioned how an interest in Asia and Japan and Zen Buddhism was important at the time. If we think about where these kinds of style of painting came from, many critics mentioned the resemblance between these painters and ink brush painting of both China and Japan, which was designed to demonstrate spontaneity and kind of elegance and a sureness of hand that combined with an openness to kind of improvisation. So if you imagine painting with an ink with a brush on paper according to the East Asian tradition, there's a tremendous amount of risk in kind of having to come out seemingly quickly and be very sure about what you're going to do. And so that kind of mentality was a part of how people viewed these kinds of paintings too, the sense of just putting the paint down. Let's make our second stop. So the second group of works I want to talk about are these three here. Although you can keep that one in mind, the one behind you, since both of these two works are by Ellsworth Kelly. This room is actually the key example I had in mind when I mentioned earlier that it's interesting to see works by artists of different generations. Because we can take these three works as examples of three artists from different generations who have very similar interests and concerns. Sam Francis is born in 1923, died in 1924. He comes in at roughly around the second generation of abstract expressionism. So by his timing, and if you think of the years of his process through art school and a move to New York,